From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This week, the Diocese of Sacramento took a major step in response to a wave of child sex abuse lawsuits by clergy and other employees within the Catholic Church. The diocese filed for bankruptcy. In a statement from Bishop Jaime Soto, the Sacramento Diocese filed for Chapter 11 on April 1st as it faces more than 250 lawsuits dating back to the 1950s. The bulk of lawsuits are thanks to a 2019 state law which lifted the statute of limitations. Bishop Soto says bankruptcy is the best way to distribute compensation to survivors as equitably as possible. Otherwise, the diocese funds would run out within the first cases that would go to trial. But advocates argue that's not the only motivation and that there are advantages to filing for bankruptcy outside of compensating sex abuse survivors within the Catholic Church. We did reach out to the Diocese of Sacramento to join us. They declined, but they referred us to their media release and their Chapter 11 webpage. To get a better understanding of how this impacts survivors, we welcome Dorothy Small and Melanie Sakota from the nonprofit Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, also known as SNAP. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Melanie, I'd like to start with you. Tell us about SNAP, which is the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, its history and how it's grown in that time.
SNAP was founded in 1988 by Barbara Blaine, who was a survivor of Catholic clergy abuse. And her idea was that people would feel better if they could talk together in community. And the idea has grown from there. The other aspect of SNAP is that we also do media presentations such as this.
How did you get involved with the nonprofit?
My friends and I had started a website to reach out to survivors of abuse in the Orthodox Christian churches. And in 2008, Barbara Blaine reached out to us, among other groups that were working in the area, but in different religions, and invited us to Chicago. And we became affiliated with SNAP at that point in time. I became a SNAP leader, started doing support meetings in the Bay Area. And then I was elected to the board of directors, and I worked there for 2016 to 2019, and then I took a position with SNAP as their survivor support coordinator in February of 2019.
What are some of the resources and support that SNAP offers?
We have a wide variety of support meetings, and after 2020, most of them are virtual. There's groups, say, in California. We have three California meetings a month, and there is also specialized meetings. There's a men's group that meets every Saturday. There are two different women's groups, one on Monday and one on Wednesday. There's groups for people who were abused as adults. Dorothy leads one of those groups. There's also a couple of groups for people who were abused by women religious.
Well, Dorothy, then that brings me to you. How long have you been part of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests?
I joined SNAP in 2019 after attending my first SNAP conference. And I was introduced by my former attorney. I also was abused in the church as an adult and went through the litigation process, and I discovered SNAP as a means of support during that time, and that was my introduction to SNAP.
Given that you have endured that, and you also came forward, you also found this nonprofit, SNAP, which you are now involved with, can you explain to us, you know, the path that you took for after you came forward and what you endured in the recent years since that happened?
Okay. It was never my intention to cause any harm, and I think none of us want that. It's very uncomfortable coming forward, especially when you're addressing a priest. When somebody is supposed to be the helper, many of us are conditioned through our education and through our indoctrination as children to trust the higher authority. They're revered, and especially when it's a priest. You know, you see them as God's right-hand man, and you don't want to get father in trouble. But I was at a place in my life, just in my own recovery process, dealing with codependency issues and childhood trauma that followed me all my life when this hit at that time. And it was not a good time to have that happen. It just stirred up the wounds that I hadn't been able to address. So I went ahead and something inside of me caused me to say no more. And I decided to speak up instead of cover up, because all my life I've been protecting everybody and I've been enabling abusers through my silence, trying not to fall out of favor. And I think maybe enough recovery had kicked in so that that strength, that inner strength, stood up for me, for that child that had to be silenced. A little bit of the adult was poking through. And I didn't want anybody else to go through that. And also, there was something wrong with the priest. And I'm a nurse, and I still have a license, although I'm not working, but I've been in medicine for 40 years. We have enormous compassion. And that can get me in trouble sometimes. I push aside the red flags and have compassion for the hurting person. So I saw his behavior as something that wasn't right, and I knew he was struggling. And I know firsthand that enabling is not love. That as a nurse, we learn that when you heal, when something is exposed and you bring light into it, you can't heal something if you cover it up. The same goes for personality and behavior. So in exposing him, I ended up falling from favor. I was in the choir and I sang as a soloist. And once you bring something like that out into the light, I know the church does not like scandal. And scandal to the church means bringing something like that into public view. But really the greatest scandal isn't our humanity and our human falling. It's not that they're meant to be perfect. We're all falling short of the mark, right? But we need to face it and be held accountable for our own actions. And to me, if I would have turned a blind eye, I would have been complicit to that person struggling, as well as pushing myself away again. And so I stood up, and that caused a lot of issues. I didn't mean to. I never intended to sue. I advocated for myself directly for 10 months with the victim advocacy, and then thought it was a reasonable thing, checking in, what did I need to recover, to heal myself? And I came up with, well, I don't need them to pay for any more therapy if I can just return.
And this was within the Diocese of Sacramento?
Yeah, and I thought I could just go back and sing. And I was banned from all ministry because I spoke out, and that just stirred quite a storm in the congregation. And really, when you think about it, when there is a victim of abuse, they're collateral victims. It's like when you have a family and one person is being abused, and that person comes forward, it threatens the security of all the other members of the family. And so I wasn't equipped. I thought everyone would just be supportive, but instead they're all suffering too. Everybody's struggling. And the pastor was struggling with what was going on and his position. I understand that, but when you're the one that's hurt, you shouldn't be in the position to be taking care of everyone else. And I was always in that position. So I was banned from ministry, and I went to see the bishop, and I asked if he would go ahead and just intervene for me, and that's all I needed. And he said that it wasn't in his practice to intervene in local church matters where volunteer positions were concerned. So in other words, he wouldn't do it. So then I could either just go somewhere else, or I prayed and I went, what do you want me to do? And that's when I pulled my laptop and found a clergy abuse attorney. And that's where the beginning of healing would take place.
When it comes to this bankruptcy that the diocese filed on Monday, what does that mean to you?
Oh, I'm so grateful to have this opportunity, because I was interviewed Monday and I didn't, what I wanted to say wasn't really captured. This is about the survivors that were abused as children that had the opportunity from 2019 to 2021, that three-year open window, to come forward and to seek justice and compensation and a sense of closure and being heard. So this is about that. And as a person who has significant childhood trauma, I can understand what that has been like, the effect that it has on your life. So you have a group of people who were able to come forward. Some haven't been able to. Some haven't even grasped the reality of what happened to them. They've blocked it. But for the ones that were able to come through for that three-year window, from what I understand, and Melanie can address this, something that she wrote, is that it was determined between the church, the survivors, and the attorneys of what the compensation would look like. And so you have these people that are looking forward to, hey, somebody hears us, this is going to come to a close, we can do this. And then in December, it's the announcement that we're going to go ahead and file for bankruptcy and all that that entails. And of course, the church has its perspective. But I think what's important is that the survivors have their perspective heard. And the gentleman that interviewed on Monday, I was in touch with him this morning. I listened to his interview again last night.
He was a survivor?
Yes. And right. And he spoke on Monday on the air with the attorney. And I listened to his interview again last night, and this morning I wrote and I said, I hear you. I hear your anger and I hear what you're saying. I understand it. This isn't about money. This is about the most precious asset that the church has, which are its people. And the ones that were injured in it are the precious ones that need the focus. So if they're going into the mindset in this three-year window that we're finally going to get justice, and wow, we can start to heal. And all of a sudden, with the bankruptcy in there, I listened to the attorney, and he said what it does is it can put it out for years. And then the technicality of the bankruptcy is that it closes disclosure.
Well, Melanie, I want you to step in because, you know, SNAP does have a statement in response to this bankruptcy. What would you like people to understand from your organization's perspective about what the Diocese of Sacramento filing Chapter 11, what that means for survivors?
Well, I think in my mind, the most important thing to remember is that a lot of these survivors have been waiting for years to come forward. Many of them were probably people who missed the earlier window in 2003. It was a short one-year window. There wasn't a whole lot of publicity about it. And then the California Supreme Court decided that people who had always remembered their abuse weren't eligible to participate in that particular window. So you have people that have been waiting since 2003 to have this opportunity to come forward. And what bankruptcy does is it rips that whole thing out from under their feet. And, you know, as you mentioned, it pushes the process further down the road. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that's even more disturbing is that the bankruptcy isn't just about addressing the lawsuits that have been filed. It's going to also, the bankruptcy court will announce a deadline when other people who may have been abused in the Diocese of Sacramento will have their last opportunity to come forward. They may not be ready. They may not realize what happens to them. And what's most disturbing is children that were abused before the bankruptcy was filed on Monday, they have to come forward too. And to me, that's an unreasonable expectation. And I think that in the last window, I know some of the dioceses, what they ended up doing was they reached a universal settlement with all the claimants. So they took everyone, and as Dorothy mentioned, the lawyers, the survivors, and the diocese worked out how much people were going to get, and then they settled for that amount. They could have done the same thing this year. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen is that in the bankruptcy doesn't care what happened in the church. They don't care about discovery. There have been exceptions, but most of that information is going about who did what, which priests were involved in the abuse, who covered up for them. That's all going to be hidden. And so I think there's two things that should be very disturbing to people. Number one, that information about perpetrators is not going to become public. And two, that children who have been abused recently, and I myself don't think that the reforms of 2002 have eliminated the problem of abuse, they're going to be cut out too. Mm-hmm. And instead, so it's not just those people who have already filed lawsuits that are going to be affected by this bankruptcy. There's a whole lot of other people. This bankruptcy, most of the people who came forward, the average age for a person to come forward is the most people come forward between age 50 and 70. So it wasn't unusual. I think in the diocese's statement, they talked about, that these were old cases.
Yeah, the diocese said that more than 80% of the lawsuits involve allegations from 1980s or earlier.
Right. But that's normal because that's how long it takes people to come forward. So there's nothing, it should not have been a surprise. But what he doesn't say is this bankruptcy is those people who were abused after the 80s. If they're not ready, if they don't remember their abuse, if they don't understand that the abuse caused repercussions in their life that they're still dealing with, or if they're just children, they don't, read the news and think about filing a lawsuit or, becoming a creditor in a bankruptcy, those people are also going to lose out. And that, to me, it's a travesty. I think this is not really about money. This is about protecting the reputation and the mission, if you will, of the church. And as Dorothy said, the most important thing in my mind to protect is the church isn't the building, the church isn't the money, the church isn't the priest. The church is the community of believers. And that's what the church failed to protect. And that's what they should be trying to deal with. They should be leaving their gift on the altar and going to make amends to the people that they have, that they know they have hurt. And it's, I don't know. To me, it's a failure of practicing what they preach.
And we have to leave it at that. But I want to thank you, Melanie, and thank you, Dorothy, for talking to us about a necessary but also a difficult topic to talk about. And I'm happy that we were able to devote as much time as we did to this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us.
Dorothy Small and Melanie Sakota are from the nonprofit Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, also known as SNAP, and they were talking about the Diocese of Sacramento filing for bankruptcy this week in response to a wave of child sex abuse lawsuits in recent years with accusations that date back decades. And as I mentioned, we did invite the Diocese of Sacramento on Insight. They declined, but they did send us a media release and their webpage that is dedicated to their Chapter 11 filing. You can find all of that on our Insight page. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.